Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann. Did you know that we process 9 billion terrestrial food animals a year in the United States? That's 65 billion around the world as of 2015. And if you include marine animals with terrestrial animals, we're nearing 200 billion animals a year. That's correct, billion with a B. That's a substantial amount. And when we look at this, we understand that there are people that are doing it well, and some people that need some lessons learned. Today, we're lucky enough to have one of those folks that's doing it well and is focused on advancements and moving in the right direction with our processing of food animals. Today, we have Arian Tiebemery from Vermont Packing House on the show with us today. Hey, Arian, how you doing today?
I'm doing all right. How about you, Aaron?
I'm well. How are things up in North Springfield, Vermont?
Going great. We are coming into spring, and I think there's a lot of farmers that are really excited about that because they are probably running a little shy on hay from the winter time and looking forward to green pastures.
That's right. Some growth, some photosynthesis and growth, right? Getting some people out there and enjoying the weather as well as our animals, right? Getting a little healthier.
Exactly. Nice for humans, right? Too. Everybody likes the sun.
Stretch the legs. So meat is a big business here, right? And it's we can look at meat being a foundation of social, economic, and political stability. These are big deals. I think the stats that we saw was that in the United States, meat actually represents, the total meat industry represents about 6% of GDP. And I dropped the numbers there that we had, you know, we're processing over 9 billion animals a year in this country. If you look at actually the growth trends of what's happening around the world, not only are we talking about that 65 billion number collectively, but we're actually looking at China by 2030 being over 20 billion animals of processed. So what I wanted to get into with is looking at what Vermont Packing House is doing differently. And one thing, doing my research and looking what you've created up there, and also I've had the opportunity to come up and visit, one thing that struck me is your commitment to transparency. And that commitment to transparency being glass windows along your kill floor in the slaughterhouse, offering tours to anyone that is interested in seeing this, whether they're your distribution or they're your providers and producers, or they're a biology class in the local high school. So maybe you can share with our audience why transparency is so essential for you and why it's so essential for a modern food system.
Well, it's a great question. As you said, it is something that we really have built into the plant. Literally, there are windows overlooking all of our processing areas from slaughter all the way to cooked hams and bacon. And the driver for that is to be consistent with the position of a lot of people in these in the food chain that that we're working in trying to be transparent, trying to, you know, people want to know more about how their food is raised, they want to know about the agricultural conditions, they want to know about the farms, they want to know about social conditions, and this is us saying, okay, we think that there's momentum behind this in all aspects, plus, I mean, gosh, who doesn't like a good company tour? Come here and check it out. We think we do sort of ride this interesting borderline because we are a slaughterhouse of people, or an intersection, I should say, of people who come here because they're interested in food and want to know more about agriculture. We also people who are just interested in processes. And then a lot of people are just curious. You know, we get comments all the time like, you know, I've eaten meat my whole life, and I've always wondered, like, what goes into the making of that. And it's nice to come here and see it. And, you know, there's that, I think for many people, there's that classic joke, you know, where does meat come from? It comes from the store. You know, just the not thinking further back. And I think there's a lot of interest from folks nowadays to know more about it. And we've taken that very seriously. And we have tour groups literally every week. We have at least one tour group. College students, farmers, chefs, physicians, local high school, quite a few different places.
And I think that's key for where you're located. As we said, you're the general manager of Vermont Packing House in Vermont. And I think there is a certain element of almost wearing it as a element of pride for folks in Vermont that they do know where their food's coming from. And it's almost a degree deeper here, right? Because to your point, and I agree with 100%, you ask people where they get the hamburger from. They say it's the grocery store or from the cafe. And the next level would be that it's from the farm. But that element of intertwining that with that there's a processing of this food animal, that's where I think you really are unique here in this space and really are pushing the envelope here, looking at it differently of immersing people so they do become more aware of that. So could you share with our audience a little bit about what you offer for services at Vermont Packing House? So, you know, there many groups are just doing a processing facility. Some do a value add or packing. It seems like you have a full gamut from everything from a live kill floor to case ready hams, bacon, and sausages.
That's true. You know, as a business, we acknowledge readily that we are a niche meat processing business. You know, we only work with farmers that are working in these sort of more sustainable channels, whether that's organic or grass-fed, pasture-raised pork, non-GMO feed. But we also work with Fred Farmer down the road who might just have one animal and maybe he, you know, didn't raise them organically, but we still would work with him or Fred or Sally or whoever. We want to be able to offer a suite of services under one roof, because one of the things that's really happened in the larger industrialization of food is a high degree of specialization. And at very high volumes, there are real efficiencies associated with this. And we will never be as efficient as the Swifts and the Tysons and the Oscar Myers of the world. We just never will be, and we acknowledge that. But what we can do alternatively is try to actually put some logistical efficiencies into our process, which means if you're a very large meat company, you would slaughter the animals in one location, you might cut them up in a different location, you might make ground beef in another third location, and sausages in a fourth location, and maybe you cut steaks and roasts in a fifth location. So each one of these is broken up into these different highly specialized processing facilities, probably highly automated as well. But if you just have one animal, or let's say you're one of our larger customers and you bring in 10 animals, you can't take the logistics of taking that around to all of these different places is a tremendous inefficiency at that scale. So we're much more efficient logistically at the smaller scale that we operate for people operating in these more sustainable alternative value chains. And that is one of our that's a core function of our business. It's one of the things that makes us viable, that somebody can just drop off an animal and we can cut them up. We can do steaks and roasts and all the normal stuff that you want. We make ground meat. We make sausages, both fresh and smoked. We do hams and bacons. We do some other specialty smoke items, smoked briskets, Canadian bacon, smoked pork loin, a number of further process items. But we can make them all from the same animal, and the exact suite of services is different based on sort of the volume size of the customer, because we can't really be all things to all people. But in general, the idea is that just drop off the animal in one place. We basically do all the processing in one place, and there's a logistical efficiency for everybody associated with that. So we don't just do that because it's a nice thing and it's a nice service to offer. We do it because it creates efficiencies and usefulness for us and for our customers.
Hmm. Let's get into a little more about this preservation of provenance, which any food animal production, especially with large carcass animals, there are it's a very robust and sophisticated supply chain. And what we've seen in very large scale producers, to your point, is it's very segmented, very siloed in the approach. And so you seem to service the needs of a regional economy here by being able to preserve some of that production and product differentiation. And you had mentioned some of those classifications, whether they're a grass-fed program or they're non-prophylactic use of antibiotics. But how do you work within processing to make sure that if one of your producers does bring in 10 head and they are associated with a certain elevated standard, during your entire time with that full carcass utilization, or for the value add, or for the primal cuts, how do you guarantee that those animals are the ones that they've brought in, or what the output is for those animals is what they brought in, and it marries and meshes with their potential of their distribution model?
That's a great question. We get asked that all the time, just because there's a classic. Many farmers, small farmers, are apprehensive about meat processors because they always feel like the butcher stole their meat. And so there's sort of a classic little bit of antagonism there. And we do also feel that the transparency of having people come in and see the process helps them understand how we do this, and thus sort of them feel a little bit more at ease with how we handle stuff. So the reality is that everything is tagged and labeled at every single step of the process. And it's very tedious. That's one of the things that also makes us less efficient than larger processors, is that every single carcass, every bit of meat at every step is tagged. Certainly, if somebody brings in two animals and they want them processed together, we will mix the ground beef or the ground pork together because that's a logical thing to do, but we will make sure that it's separate, processed separately and distinctly from anybody else's meat. So we do that in a lot of ways by basically, like, when we're cutting those animals, let's say when we're cutting a beef carcass, the carcass or carcasses that are on that order are the only ones that are on the table. Then we clear the table, we process that order, we clear the table, and we process the next order. So it just is, there's clean breaks at the step all along the way. And when we process the one order, we remove the tag from the order. We do all the breaking and the work on it, and then we place a new label back on it, identifying here's what that order is. And so it is a very tedious and meticulous process with a tremendous amount of record keeping. Some people might, some people have, people in food processing and in agriculture in general have sometimes in the past complained that, like, oh, organic certification is really tedious because there's so many records you have to keep and you have to monitor everything at every step just so you can guarantee the integrity of every single order or of the organic product throughout the process. And for us, it's like, yeah, no big deal. We do that all for every order anyway. All we have to do is just make sure we do the organic orders at the beginning of the day on totally clean equipment, and because we can do a non-organic order after an organic order. They can touch the same table, but you can't do vice versa. The organic has to be on a totally clean table versus you can have a non-organic cow that you process afterwards touch that same table and it's fine. But otherwise, the record keeping is like exactly the same, and so it's really not a big deal for us.
We deal a lot with the local food economy, especially in the Northeast, where we're, I think, pretty well known for sourcing 6 to 7% of our own food system. It's depending on the category of food, it does variance is involved here, but it's a minimal amount compared to the actual population densities that we have and the potential that we could service with local or regional food production. And what I'm intrigued by with what you have established with Vermont Packing House is looking at the ability to start bridging that local food movement and local production into wholesale distribution. And so in looking at your thesis from Iowa State University, so that you discovered that the issue at hand was actually that the industry as a whole is out of sync and in need of better coordination and resources. So the question we always run into, I obviously focus on more on the production side here, is that the perceived bottlenecks always get put on you. They always get put on the processor. And I think in conversations with you, I've learned that that's not the case. And maybe you can explain to the audience why that may not be the case. It may actually be we need more commitments from larger buyers to actually scale up the required processing, the value add, the additional services that could be there to start to mesh and marry. So it's the middle market. Is that correct in saying that? And maybe you could provide some details.
Yes, yeah. And I think I'll start off with a sort of simple example and then give you some more concrete ones. You know, I wrote, published a report with the Economic Research and Economic Research Service of the USDA and my friend Lauren Gwynn from Oregon State University, and I refer to myself sometimes as a recovering academic because I spent a fair amount of time working in academia before coming out of the ivory tower to get my hands dirty in the slaughterhouse. But it was called From Convenience to Commitment, and the sort of underlying premise is that basically if the basis of the relationship is convenience, like I can show up whenever, again, the classic example is many smaller farmers, you'll hear them say, I can't, every time I call my meat processor, the slaughterhouse that's close to me, they always are full. And on a superficial surface, this is true. The challenge is that due to the seasonality of livestock cycles, where it is economically advantageous to slaughter animals in the fall and not in the winter and the spring, because they're coming off of feed, and feed is basically free in the summertime, especially for ruminants, and animals put on more weight in warmer weather more quickly because in the wintertime they're metabolizing to keep themselves warm so they don't put on that same weight gain. They don't get red and finished as nicely. So if I'm a farmer and I call the processor and they say, yes, we're full, is the problem with the processor if I always call and try to get an animal in October? If we dig into this a little bit deeper, we find that the business on the whole of meat processing is strong seasonal cycles. And so everybody calls. Like, for example, we will start booking in May. We will have in May and June, we will have most of our entire fall season booked. But in February, March, April, we are always slow. We're okay, we do fine, but every processing business is slower, including us. And so what that means is some times of the year, there's quote unquote not enough capacity, but a lot of other times of the year there's excess capacity. And it's really hard for many small processors to expand their business just because they're busy 3 months out of the year. How do they pay for that expansion for the rest of the year? To expand, this is a highly capital intensive business. You know, the joke, everything costs tens of thousands of dollars. Buildings cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to millions. And so these expansions are really capital intensive. And to do it just for a small or just for seasonal fluctuation for basically a quarter of the year, you just can't make it pencil out. It just isn't worth it. So the notion of convenience to commitment is that if everybody is just focused on this sort of logic of conducting business when it's convenient for them. You know, a farmer will bring animals when it's convenient for them. Then a processor will process those animals in a way that is convenient for them, i.e. they will not expand their business. They won't add on to the facility. They'll take the business they can get in the fall, and they'll hunker down through the winter in the slow season and try to make the year even out. They'll make good money in the months when it's in the fall, and the rest of the year they might lose money and just hope that it all breaks even at the end of the year. It's not something that anybody can build a business on. So commitment would mean I would be a farmer or a company making a commitment to say, I'm going to bring you animals every month of the year, regardless of the season. And if you do that, I want you to guarantee to the processor saying, if you do that, I want you to guarantee that the slots that I'm committing to will be there. And that's like a pretty, in some ways, it's so small, but it's kind of it's a mind shift in how the business orientation works. And so, you know, we have historically had the perspective, and I think we've really stood by this, of we will commit to producers who commit to us. So meaning if the producer is willing to make a commitment 6 to 12 months in advance, we will do everything we can to meet that commitment, because we want to work with people who will make commitments to us. We want to make commitments to them, because that builds trust, and trust builds business.
So that's a great point. And I mean, obviously you have skilled laborers here too. These people that are actually cutting up the different elements or doing the value add.
And they want jobs all year round too. They want paychecks. They want 40 hours every week, even when it's slow.
Right.
You know, they want a little bit of overtime in the fall is okay, but not too much. You know, the bank wants a payment every single month. The power bill, we got to pay it every single month. We have so many commitments that we're on the line for that we need to base our business on sound commitments from other people.
And you're running on tight margins throughout the whole period. So it makes sense when you have this commitments and you know, it is kind of an evolution we're seeing in broader economics, an economic model that we've seen as somewhat of a new cost basis is this idea of circular economies, which is really starting to solidify around these regions or bioregions associated with that, because you do know the people that you're doing business with. And there is a certain value that when there's downtimes, you need those commitments to make your business operate properly, or to have a ability to then work with partners or compatriots that can pick up some of the, when you have an excessive amount of demand, that they can work with you in the correct bioregion to service that demand, and vice versa. So have you seen...
Absolutely. Yeah. And you see that in how our business is built and has grown. So for example, you know, we started operations here in 2014, in the middle of 2014. We opened the door with 10 people and we now have 60. So 3.5 years later, we've got 60 people. It's been a pretty steep growth curve, but 80% of our business is coming from what we would call commercial accounts. These are accounts that are distributors or marketing groups that are working with groups of farmers to consistently have livestock available all year round. These are customers that come, many of them come every week, all of them come at least once a month, and they bring consistent volumes that are scheduled months in advance. And that is what gives us the consistency to grow our business, to continue to invest in this facility. You know, we have put in the last year, we put $1.5 million, invested $1.5 million in this facility, and we couldn't do that. We love working with small farms down the road. The little projects fit well around the big projects, and there's a lot of philosophical reasons, so we also think that those are important. But at the end, you know, we pay our bills and with our anchor customers. And so that is a good business model for us in that, you know, again, these aren't like huge behemoths. It's not like we're working with Tyson as an anchor customer. You know, some of our biggest customers, you know, maybe they bring 40 or 50 hogs in a week, which from a very small farm standpoint is a big number. But from the grand scheme of, you know, I visited hog facilities in the Midwest that kill 20,000 hogs a day. It's like, we didn't kill 20,000 animals last year.
Yeah, orders of magnitude difference, right? And
they're 100 times bigger than us, if not more.
Right. And so the only way to compete, right, is to find differentiation, is finding a
Absolutely.
Way of having those commitments to your community, to your workers, to your anchor customers, to basically guarantee that it starts to service a new demand where consumers are much more engaged and are starting to look layers deep, whether it is where their food is coming from the farm and also from the processing facilities. And I think that's a very positive step. And I mean, for you to embrace that is, many may not consider it part of an agro-tourism type model, but it really is. It really is engaging consumers that if they have this comfort level, if they have the insurance that any meat coming from your facility is going to be up to the highest standards, well, boy, that is almost the insurance element that many people will need for doing this properly.
And come here and check it out. You know, I mean, that's not to say that we never have any issues, that equipment doesn't break and everything goes perfectly every day. But, you know, we're pretty transparent about what goes on here.
Yeah. So let me pick your brain about one other thing. I'm intrigued to get your perspective on this. This is we've had a lot of interest, and it's more of, I think, media buzz associated to plant-based meat protein alternatives. And, you know, for some folks, it's the only way of the future. For other people like vegetarians and vegans, you know, it's a meat or protein source that they can ethically eat. For others, mm-hmm. it's a fad driven by investors who are just seeking something else that they can control and get their quick hit returns. And for others, within many in the meat industry, look at Beyond Meat or Impossible Foods as Velveeta or Cheese Whiz equivalent for meat production. So I'm going to ask that with a bit of a leading question, knowing who I'm talking to here, but where do you stand on that? Do you actually see this as competition, or do you see it as a way to trigger more interest in consumers that are engaged in their food system? They're asking questions and to know that, boy, we got 9 billion animals that are being processed this every year in this country, most without the type of transparency or the integrity that you offer. Do you see that as a way to start to capture some of that gray area and become more engaged?
Well, I think, you know, personally, I have always approached this business from a philosophical perspective about, you know, I want to see more sustainable agriculture happen. I want to see people thinking more about where their food comes from and how it affects them and how it affects our planet. And so I think that I am more definitely towards the latter of your conversation of your point of, hey, this is a valid conversation. I think that there are, it's a valid conversation about what goes into all of these foods we're eating, and are there certain sources of them that are, you know, should we explore some of these other options? You know, my own father is practically vegan by choice, not that he has any philosophical qualms with what we do here, but I very much respect his decision, and when I go have dinner with him, I have essentially vegan dinner. He likes butter because he's French, and French people like butter.
Some things you just can't sacrifice, right?
Yeah, something, you know, yeah, exactly. There's, you know, there's French vegans, they eat butter. And so I am intrigued by the conversation. Does it, and I think, you know, there's a lot still to be learned. You probably don't hear this from a lot of people who are in the meat business, but I do think on the whole, like, we as Americans eat too much meat. I definitely try to take at least a day a week where I don't have any meat. I think the point is eat less meat, but eat better meat and know more about where it's coming from and really and enjoy it when you have it. And don't just eat bad meat for the sake of eating meat. Hmm. I like eating meat, but I also see some of these other ramifications, and I think it's good not to only eat meat. Vegetables, pretty important. Whole grains, pretty important. I know it makes me feel better when I have a balanced diet like that. So, you know, from again coming back to that philosophical perspective, I think that the debate and the discussion, as long as we're candid and we're looking at these things from objective perspectives, you know, that we are using a little bit more of a scientific lens to look at what the downstream contributions are of these various products and processes. You know, the notion of some of these protein alternatives is like, okay. You know, sounds interesting. I've eaten many of them, and some are better. You know, some I really liked, and some it's like, I don't know. I hope, you know, and it just from a personal taste preference wasn't my favorite. But, you know, I think it's a healthy discussion as long as we're not straying too far into the sort of marketing fad of some of these things, but more in terms of, like, what are we doing? You know, what are the impacts of our actions?
So, Aaron, you mentioned that you've been doing this since 2014. So for my last question for you, it's where do you see the growth of the industry? Where do you see scalability for Vermont Packing and for some of the models that you've developed moving forward?
Great question. You know, we see a lot of growth in continuing to be decentralized in just sort of the working. We're trying to actually build another facility, looking strongly, probably in Western Massachusetts. So just a couple hours of here. The point would not be to add on to this facility sort of continuously and grow into this behemoth meat processing plant, which we really do not want to be, but to continue this sort of model of keeping small plants decentralized and pushing that forward. And working with partners in those little regions. And just we're blessed to have a lot of people here in the Northeast and a lot of markets associated with that, and also to have some pretty good ground for raising livestock, particularly ruminants. As you know well, Aaron, that just the pastures of the Northeast are pretty fertile from a grass production standpoint. They may not be the most fertile from a corn and soybeans, and not as tillable as some parts of the Midwest. And so probably actually a really good and long-term sustainable form of agriculture in this region is pasture-based. Mm-hmm. And so we do see a good, a solid production base, particularly for ruminants, and then huge markets of Boston and New York and the like. So keeping just a couple hours away from here, we think we can do that. We also see some opportunities in some other locations. This Vermont Packing House is the second facility that we have worked. My business partners run a small meat processing plant in Minnesota called Lawrence Meats, and they sort of have a proof of concept model out there about focusing on these niche markets in a small plant, highly dedicated transparency, and we worked with other partners to put this facility in the Northeast to see how it went. It's worked really well, and we're thinking about, okay, could we do another smaller kind of decentralized plant in the Northeast? I think it's a real question what the end game is on this. You know, like how many of these little plants could we do? What percentage of this market is capturable? You know, those are really good questions. You know, I think that are anybody's guess. I don't think we have a great answer. You know, my guess, I would love to see at least 10% of the meat sold in this country be organic or grass-fed or pasture-raised or no hormones and antibiotics or non-GMO-fed, some of these alternatives that are taking steps, maybe not perfect, but taking steps in the right direction towards being more sustainably produced. And, you know, once we get to 10%, I think we'll be able to reassess about what that landscape looks like and what the outlook is.
That's right. It's like any other market penetration. When you can start to cross that chasm and you engage more consumers with it on a cost-effective way of bringing it to market, it does change the paradigm. And I also think around the Northeast, one of the things that we do offer, and we've seen this with four nor'easters in March, is plenty of water. And with the average head of cattle taking 50 gallons a day, that's very important. And many of our grasslands that have gone further down desertification, that's a big deal. Water becomes a major play. So
yeah, we are very lucky.
We are. Yeah. We are. Although after 5 feet of snow in Vermont, I think some people may, if you're not skiing.
the ski mountains love it.
They do. Know? They do.
They're so excited.
That's the other economic driver there is run the ski mountain and the beef animals in the summer. So, hey, Arian, where can our listeners learn more about Vermont Packing or possibly sign up to do one of these tours?
So they can go to our website, vermontpackinghouse.com. And there's contact information there. I think folks can just reach out to us by phone or email. And if it's just like one or two people, we might ask them to join another group. If there's a large enough group, we would probably give them a tour on their own. So people who really just call and email out of the blue and just like, hey, I'd like to come by. And then we have a lot of organized groups. So like I said, particularly classes and colleges and culinary schools and that kind of stuff. Every single week we've got at least one.
Fantastic. Well, Aaron Timboumerie, thank you. As Niederhem, as we talked about, I always try to get this right, the last name. So, Aaron, I appreciate you taking the time. I learned a great deal, and I know our listeners will as well. So thanks for sharing knowledge on Sourcing Matters.
Great. Thank you so much, Aaron. Appreciate the invitation.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Bye.